The number of people working in the field is greatly enlarged over what it was before. The number of programs, the number of conferences that we have every year, in addition to this type of annual conference, the smaller conferences like the one on ethics and the one on radical behaviorism at West Virginia. The number of areas in which behavior analysts work is much larger than it was before, and probably there are no areas really excluded at this point. Anything that can be defined as an area of human interest has some behavior analysts working in it. So in a sense, the good news is that we have grown a great deal. From the perspective of the teacher, I guess, just looking at it kind of narrowly, the good news is all the stuff we have now to teach, all these books and all these articles and all these papers, particularly, let's say, all these books. Now, the bad news is nobody seems to be reading them. No, that's not exactly true. There are a lot of people reading them, and the bad news is really more complicated than that. Let me go into the bad news in a little more historical way. The early days of behavior modification were largely, and that was during this period, say, the late 50s and the 60s, the early 60s, the people who were in the field, who entered the field of what was then called behavior modification, were largely academicians, and many of them had the same general orientation that I had, I think, and I'll describe my own, assuming that it also characterizes a number of other people. I discovered this very fine print that you see here that nobody can read, says, in 1955, I found Skinner and was saved from the analysis of variance, from math models, and from the conceptual nervous system. Well, I was an academician, essentially. I read Science and Human Behavior and became, in a sense, in a few weeks, became converted to that general orientation. It was far better than anything I'd done before, or I'd seen before. It seemed obvious to me that it was of great importance, and also carried a sort of worldview that was very important also. It was clear that the important thing to do was to behavioralize the culture as quickly as possible. And it was clear that the way to do this was through the science of behavior and through the general characteristics of behaviorism as a worldview. There was a kind of a desperate temporal characteristic to it, which I think still is in effect. We may not have too much time left to behavioralize the culture. My interest in the applied area was forced on me. I was a teacher, and I talked about behavior analysis and science and human behavior, lectured about it, argued about it, gave talks about it in public and various things. And most of the students at Kansas University, which is where I was located at that time, most of the students were clinical students. And so I was constantly being challenged to deal with practical problems, not necessarily to deal with them overtly, but at least to talk about them. How would you as a behaviorist, how would Skinner, how would the behavioral approach deal with this topic, that topic, with schizophrenia, with the mental retardation, with the adult neurotic, with anxiety reactions, with things of this sort. And so I was forced to constantly deal with those issues. What would the behaviorist have to say about education? What would you say about industrial and business problems, and so on? I was constantly forced to deal with those, and science and human behavior was an excellent basis for it. There were, well, I had science and human behavior, one, two, and shortly thereafter, I had Keller and Schoenfeld as a background also, and I got a copy of the William James Lectures in about 1955 from Skinner. It had not been published, it wouldn't be published until 1957, but those William James Lectures on verbal behavior, plus the other three things, gave me the answers to everything. There were no topics that I couldn't deal with, at least speculatively, and it turned out that wasn't so bad because nobody else was dealing with them much more than speculatively anyway. I didn't have to do much to exceed the effectiveness in talking about these topics of the ordinary clinical psychologist. So this was the type of thing that maintained my behavior in that area, and also interested students. I never convinced any of the cognitive psychologists at Kansas University Psychology Department. Remember, this is KU in the 50s, long before the Department of Human Development had the behavioral orientation it does now. And I'm talking about the psych department, which still has a somewhat screwed orientation. So when I talk about KU, it really has nothing to do with the Department of Human Development, which is quite a different arrangement. In any case, I got into these applied areas by challenge, in a sense, and while I didn't work in them very much, I became interested in them to some degree. When I left Kansas in 1957 and went to University of Houston, I met Lee Meyerson, and he got me involved again as a challenge into specific applied work, largely with the mentally retarded. He had a specific problem he wanted to work with. He was a cognitive psychologist in the old Levinian sense of cognitive, not the information theory or information transmission approach to cognitive psychology, and he had the problem of testing, or wanted to be able to test effectively the hearing of profoundly and severely retarded children or adults, and who could not easily be tested by the ordinary audiometry techniques that were available at that time. And he asked me, you know, if you know so much about behavior and if behavior isn't so good, how would you do this? And I said, well, that's easy. It didn't turn out to be all that easy, but it was in principle easy. Donald Blau had already developed a technique, a fine technique for testing the visual acuity, or rather the absolute threshold of pigeons, and we simply modified the technique to test the hearing of the mentally retarded. And it worked out pretty well in general. My main orientation towards that, as I believe many of the behavior modifiers' orientation was at that time, that I was simply helping out in an area that certainly could use the help. But it was not a major interest of mine to work in the area of mental retardation or in the area of mental illness. I felt like there was no better way to deal with those areas than behavioral, and I wanted as quickly as possible to have the people in those fields learn about behavioral approaches so that everything could be improved. But my real goal was, as I said before, to behavioralize the culture. My real goal was to convert the culture to one in which there was not an emphasis on interdeterminers, but rather a close look at the environment as the cause of behavior, a culture in which the concepts of behavioral analysis and the principles of behavior were widely known and made effective use of, and a culture in which all previous types of notions could still be dealt with, were not simply swept under the carpet or not dealt with, but were dealt with behaviorally. And I wanted to have a personnel who could do this. That was my major goal, and work toward the survival of the human species. The areas of applied psychology that I got myself into, worked with the mentally ill, with the mentally retarded, with the physically disabled, with very young children, and so on, these were simply, although very valuable areas in their own right, from my perspective, they were mainly ways in which I could show people how valuable it was to know about behavior analysis and how important it was to know about behavior analysis. And in the process of showing them that, I could talk them into being behaviorists, or at least I could move the behavioral movement a little further on. And that was the major goal. A good example that illustrates this major goal is the attitude I had towards work with children in classrooms. I could see that it was valuable early in the game to improve the teacher's ability to deal with children in the classroom. In other words, contingency management in the classroom is an important topic. It would help the teacher teach. And so behavior analysis can certainly contribute to that. That it could contribute to it, of course, was not a research issue, it was a foregone conclusion, and the matter was simply to work out the details. Likewise, the instructional materials in elementary education needed work. We needed better understanding of stimulus control, better understanding of programming, better design of materials, where the materials to be taught or to be used in teaching were